ونمشي ما نمشي the mind. Avikala changeless. Purman the living entity. Yati approaches. Tat samyatam the same condition of agitation as the mind. Padre, oh my gentle mother, he indeed alinga without a subtle or gross body. Lingavan, possessing a material body. Eva, as if. Translation. In the same way, oh my gentle mother, when the mind is agitated by the movements of the modes of material nature, the living entity, although freed from all the different phases of the subtle and gross bodies, thinks that he has changed from one condition to another. Purport by his divine grace, this is Bhaktivedanta Swami Shabbat. It's stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, 1084.13, a human being who identifies the body made of three elements as the self, who considers the byproducts of the body to be his kinsmen, who considers the land of his birth worshipable, and who goes to a place of pilgrimage simply to bathe rather than to meet men of transcendental knowledge, is to be considered like a cow or an ass. Unquote. Although Hiranyakashipu was a great demon, he was not as foolish as the population of the modern world. Hiranyakashipu had clear knowledge of the spirit soul and the subtle and gross bodies, but now we are so degraded that everyone, including the so-called exalted scientists, philosophers, and other leaders, is under the bodily conception of life, which is condemned in the Shastras. Such persons are nothing but cows and asses. Hiranyakashipu advised his family members that although the gross body of his brother Hiranyaksha was dead, and they were aggrieved because of this, they should not lament for the great soul of Hiranyaksha, who had already attained his next destination. Atma, the spirit soul, is always unchanged. We are spirit souls, but when carried away by mental activities, manodharma, we suffer from so-called material conditions of life. This generally happens to non-devotees. Non-devotees may possess exalted material qualities, but because they are foolish, they have no good qualifications. The designations of the conditioned soul in the material world are decorations of the dead body. The conditioned soul has no information of the spirit and its exalted existence beyond the effects of the material condition. Chakshuramulitamyena tasmai Shri Guruvye Namah Shri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Yena Bhutve Swayam Rupa Kadamaya Kadabdi Swapadam Dikam Hare Krishna Karana Sindhu Dina Vandeti Garpite Gopesha Kupika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastate Tata Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Vrindavaneshwara Vishwami Sute Devi Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaur Bhaktivedanta Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Translation again, please repeat. In the same way, oh my gentle mother, when the mind is agitated by the movements of the modes of material nature, the living entity, Although free from all the different phases of the subtle and gross bodies, thinks that he has changed from one condition to another. Hiranyakashipu, great demon of yore, speaking Vedic wisdom to console the relatives of his brother Hiranyaksha after the death of that great demon, exalted death, but how he did Lord Vishnu. So Srila Prabhupada is explaining that Hiranyakashipu is much more exalted than modern day demons who have, in general, no understanding of the soul. And as Hiranyakashipu is explaining in this verse, it is by misidentification with the mind and of the mind with the most material nature that are always interacting and changing in a very ephemeral way within the larger context of time. That the living entity thinks that his conditions are changing from birth to youth to maturity to old age and to death. And by gross identification with the material body, one thinks that death is the end. Whereas one with more subtle attachments and subtle identification to the mind that helps us and false ego can understand that they continue on, and they just, even in this life, our mind is developing the present body and the next body according primarily to our thoughts, which are the building blocks for our material existence, our gross material existence. But none of this has anything to do with the real person. Srila Prabhupada cited an experience in his youth when his father, who was a cloth merchant, Srila Prabhupada explained, I would hear my father quoting prices in his sleep for sales of cloth. And Srila Prabhupada said, so he was selling cloth in his dream, and our night dreams are reflections of our daydreams. But it's all a dream. It's all a grand illusion. Because the spirit soul has nothing really to do with material nature. It's a foreign substance to its actual self. And the whole concept is an illusion. And the whole life is simply a dream. So Hiranyakashipu had this understanding of the nature of the self. But he had the wrong conclusion. He was very clear on the preliminary concepts of the eternal nature of the soul and the nature of its suffering and agitation due to misidentification with the body and the mind and its environment, its imagined dream environment of the three modes of material nature within the context of time. But he had a very twisted understanding of the goal and purpose of the existence of the soul. The soul can never be satisfied in identification with material nature. And most of all, we find that what the soul is yearning for is loving relationships. In today's world, there's probably never been so much propaganda about love. The yearning for love and the frustrations of love. But that's not love. The alliances made between different conditioned souls in their dream state in pursuance of some illusory goal, it's not love. It's business. And what goes on in the name of love with all its dramatic effects is nothing but exploitation. Everyone is so eager, so yearning for someone to take away their feelings of brokenness and loneliness and isolation, that when they find someone who gives some relief to a burning experience of loneliness and the pain of isolation, then these people become very attached. But what happens in relationships fostered with such, born with such attachment? What happens is you very quickly learn that the person who initially gave some hope of reaching into the depths of your heart and soothing the pain and taking away the loneliness actually just revealed more and more the depth of your pain. And at that crucial point in the life of a relationship, it is crucial to understand the key to loving relationships, the key to harmony, individually, collectively, socially, universally. What is it, really, to sum it up in one word, that the soul is yearning for? Peace. There is these two basic desires, shreyas and prayas. Peace of the mind and the heart and soul for one who identifies with the real self, or happiness born out of material pleasure for one who misidentifies with the gross encasings which holds the soul captive in his own pain and isolation and loneliness. So, Bhagavan Tapasam Sagarama Maheshwaram Suraram Sarabhutalam Nagar Shantamajdi. Krishna says those great souls who understand that Krishna is the enjoyer, the true benefactor of all sacrifices and austerities, the Lord and proprietor of all planets and demigods thereon, and the supreme loving friend of every living entity. That's very crucial. Those souls find peace from the pangs of material nature. And what is it about material nature which is so burning to the heart? It's the conflagration, born of the conflict between the different jivas, all competing for a position of control for the purpose of enjoyment and wanting to place themselves in the center. And we have innumerable jivas all conflicting and competing for the central position. The result is simply hellish. It is just a conflagration. So, to his good instructions, good on one level, because it shows some understanding, but misdirected toward the wrong conclusion. Simultaneous to this, Hiranyakashipu is guiding his demoniac assistants to wreak utter havoc on earth, specifically targeting the places where the ingredients for sacrifice and performance of sacrifice are flourishing. So, Krishna, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, is instructing the living entities through the medium of Arjuna in the necessity of performing sacrifice. Sacrifice for Vishnu must be performed. Otherwise, all our activities, be they good or bad in the dream state, simply create more bondage to the very cycle of samsara, which we are striving to be free of. And the demigods are pleased by sacrifice. The question came up a few days ago, how is it actually that the demigods are appeased and pleased by the performance of sacrifice? And the example is always given of paying taxes to the different governmental divisions. But offering sacrifice is not really meant to be like paying taxes. That's an analogy, a gross analogy, which is helpful to understand the principle, which is very deficient, as are most analogies. What the governmental head of the universe really desire is that the living entities in that government are obedient to the laws and the purpose of that creation. The purpose of this material creation is to experience the ramifications of our independent desire to enjoy separately from Krishna. And when the frustrations and pain and anguish and loneliness becomes sufficient, that we cry out to the Lord in humility and desperation to free us, then the desire for liberation awakens. But that is also selfish, because it is based on one's own pleasure, or conversely, freedom from pain. And it's not really love. Sacrifice is meant to give birth to love. And therefore the demigods are pleased, because the demigods are devotees. They may not be pure devotees. They may be in some cases. But they're devotees. They're performing these functions usually because they're karma nishabhatas. They have some desire to control. But they're doing it according to Krishna's will. And Krishna's will is that all living entities come back home, back to God, and find relief from the sufferings of this nightmare of material existence. So, understanding that the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices is Lord Vishnu, Hiranyakashipu understood that sacrifice is the root which nourishes the universal tree of life. And by cutting that root, the demigods, directly their offerings, will wither and die, as will their master, Lord Vishnu. But this is not a correct understanding. Lord Vishnu and the demigods are not dependent upon our meager offerings of sacrifice. they're desirous. Because as in any endeavor, say, a very crude analogy of athletics, there's an ethic, commonly known, that if any athlete is motivated by the desire to be a star, then that's not a team. But any athlete who is motivated to work in such a harmonious, cooperative spirit that the team will be victorious, then that team is most likely to be victorious. But the most important thing is you get the spirit. It's called generically team spirit. And you find, even amongst animals, the teamster knows that you can take, say, one good ox, and you take another good ox, or for the sake of the linguistics used in defining power, say a horse, you take one good horse, and team him up with another good horse. And you have two horses and three horsepower. Well, where does the third horsepower come from? Any good teamster knows that if you take the two good horses, meaning those who work harmoniously and cooperatively, not competitively, not seeking victory over the other, but cooperatively, humbly, harmoniously, it creates a synergistic formula in which there is more power than the combined ingredients. And you find it also in herbal formulas. But there are certain formulas of certain herbs that produces an effect greater than the added up effects of each individual component. Well, where did the additional energy, the additional effect, the additional potency come from? It's called synergistic formula. It's born of synergy. Well, these crude analogies of the material world, everything in the material world is meant to teach us something about the spiritual reality. When there is cooperation, when there is harmony, this is working with the intent of the creation. And then there's a tremendous goodwill and blessings from above. And that creates the additional potency. So, Hiranyakashipu had his demoniac agents destroying all the ingredients for sacrifice, cutting the roots, cutting down the trees that provide the fruits and flowers for sacrifice, destroying the cowherd villages because the cows are so precious in sacrifice, and attacking and terrorizing those living entities who are inclined to perform sacrifice. So, this is in ancient times. Today, we can perform sacrifice relatively peacefully. We don't have terrorists focusing all their wrath on the other. At least not today. Apparently the demons have learned something over the yugas, that they can't kill Vishnu, but they can attain the same desired effect by cutting at the root of sacrifice, the root of worship, the root of our connection in loving relationship with Krishna.
by cutting at the root of our faith. But demons, as we see here in the case of Hayao Yashiku, they're not always ignorant about the nature of the science of the soul. Adolf Hitler, amongst the greatest demons this world has ever known, was very conversant with the science of the soul. He was very fond of the Aryan race, according to his understanding, which was total disembodied misidentification. Aryan race meant 6 feet tall, blonde hair, blue eyes. And they were very fond of performing sacrifice. But the sacrifice Hitler loved to perform was absolutely hideous and degrading. So demons, and Hitler, he was just wiping out the Allies when they tried to oppose him. He was very learned in military science. He studied the Vedas. But what is the goal, the purpose of the Vedas? Is to understand Vishnu. When General Patton arrived on the battlefront and the Nazis were having a little preliminary introductory film about the new ally general, they were noting with interest everything that was being stated. And when they heard that he believes in reincarnation, they looked at one another a little fearful, understanding that now they had to confront an actual Kshatriya. So just understanding that the soul is eternal is really not a sign of great intelligence. It's mainly a matter of common sense. But what we need to understand is what is the motivation which inspires the demons to want to kill Vishnu, or the modern day demons to want to destroy our faith in a loving relationship with the most merciful Lord. What is the motivation? Today, we don't have big demons making propaganda, or as Hiranyakashipu is doing here, seeking support for his campaign to kill Vishnu. Apparently the demons have figured out over the yugas that you can't kill Vishnu. If the jiva soul is eternal, then possibly the supreme soul is also. But they have a reason. They have a very distinct motive. Or to do away with devotees of the Lord. What is the motive? Devotees are quite harmless and peaceful and gentle. Why is it that the devotees want to do away with them? It's not just that it inflames their envy towards the Lord that the devotees serve. If you look at the campaigns today against sacrifice, worship, devotional service, religion, the campaigns are very subtle. So subtle as to be easily overlooked, easily not even identified. We can see so much and learn so much, not only from the books of Srila Prabhupada, but in his own personal life and responses to different experiences of this world. Whenever the word scientist came up, I think so many times, Srila Prabhupada would become very animated. Very vigorous. And practically speaking, so much of his life was dedicated to counteract the demoniac scientific theories, knowing that there's a motivation in the personalities behind these theories, which is totally destructive to truth. And it's not just some simple ignorance on the part of the scientists being somewhat not very well conversant with Shastra, but there's a definite demoniac motive to destroy religion. Not overtly necessarily. In the worst demoniac states, like that of the communist regimes, which is very atheistic, they like to have some nice little churches with some peaceful little monks. They accept that. But they cite it as the three arch enemies: American dress, American music, which are not really enemies. It just makes people unmanageable when they take the American ways. But the worst arch enemy of the communist regime is the Hare Krishna movement. Even they, demons, they understood that anybody who applies his mind to trying to understand Srila Prabhupada's books will not be a slave to some demoniac regime. So therefore, the demons tried to strike at the faith of the devotees. Why? Without faith, there's no substance or dignity to moral principles. Without moral principles, there's no foundation to religion. There may be religion, but it has no foundation. It's so shaky because the faith is weakened. And without faith, we don't really, in the core of our hearts, believe deeply, substantially, in a loving relationship with the merciful Lord. So what is the motivation which inspires the demons to strike at our faith? Because then they can control and exploit and manipulate the masses according to their egotistic will. And the people are just puppets. They don't have the fortitude to resist the temptations of the mind, the advertisements of the world, the seductions of Maya. They're puppets, and they have the material nature. Whereas behind the scenes, pulling the strings of these demons, who want to exploit, manipulate, and control the masses according to their own egotistic ambitions. So the scientific theories in the science books of today seem to make a lot of sense. Obviously, they were very well thought out. And in most cases, if they were taken from the scientific theories created by, in the East, the great sages, in the West, it was mainly the original scientists or men of the church, men of God, who wanted to go deeper into the mysteries and intricacies of science to explain in more wonderful ways the creation for the purpose of glorifying the Creator. But like any good thing, when it falls into the wrong hands, it's used for the wrong purpose. So today's scientists, not the real scientists, but the pseudoscientists, take the original theories of creation and give it a little twist, just like Jhana Kashyapu. He's given proper wisdom as far as the eternal nature of the soul and the futility and lamentation for the changes of the body. And he has nothing to do with the soul. But then he gives it its own twist. He's not taking the initial understanding of the nature of the soul and leading it to its conclusion in loving devotional service to the soul of all souls, the dearmost friend of every soul, in whom alone they will find their eternal fulfillment and satisfaction and peace.
Without faith, without substantial faith in the Lord, we do not have the ability to control the mind, to control the senses, and therefore our understanding of the temporary nature of the body and the eternal nature of the soul remains theoretical and abstract and can't really help us at the time of death or even the time of life when it comes to resisting the temptations of demoniac influence to drag us down deeper into the vortex of misery and bondage and ignorance.
So Srila Prabhupada invested so much of his precious life into teaching real silence, that life comes from life, it does not come from matter. The science of creation, the purpose of creation. And what we have to learn from creation about the Creator, and most of all, the conclusion of all wisdom in Bhaktivedanta, his own name testifies in mission, to teach that Bhakti is the conclusion of all vague conclusions. So, living entities are so attracted to the concept of loving relationship, they get so attached to loving relationships. But what do we find is the fate of most loving relationships? Friendships in time, meaning passage of time of universal calendar. In the Kali Yuga, when everything becomes increasingly infected with quarrel and hypocrisy, we find that friendships become more and more superficial. Marriages have less and less hope of lasting. And the very persons in whom we invest all our hopes for giving us a sense of inner peace only reveal to us more and more the depths of our hopelessness and pain and isolation. It's not the person's fault. The fault is in our consciousness. Relationships are meant to be a testimony to God's love for us. When Jesus sent his apostles out, it was always in pairs, never alone. That their lives and their relationships, along with their words, could be a testimony to God's love for this world. And without, or just think of it in terms of hands, we so much are inclined to cling to others in great fear and hope that they can protect us from our own anguish of isolation and loneliness. And clinging hands are very tight, whereas hands joined in prayer have space to shelter a third party. Meaning, or as I always cite the example of the Ark of the Covenant, which was sheltered in the outstretched wings of Gandharvas, meaning that the Lord likes to reside in the shelter of loving relationships. But He is the source of loving relationships. He is the only hope for loving relationships. So, without the Lord, as Srila Prabhupada said, Krishna is the central, pivotal point for all loving relationships. And without that crucial factor, then our needs turn into demands. So-called love turns into violence. Looking tenderly turns into looking suspiciously. Hearing turns into overhearing. And intimacy is likely to degenerate into rape. Whereas relationships committed to a life as testimony to the Lord's love for us creates a safe space where Krishna can reside in the center of our lives and our relationships. So in Kali Yuga, when all Vedic processes collapse due to the unfavorable nature of practically everything in the environment, the most merciful Lord, knowing the extreme troublesome nature of this age, which happened to coincide with the time of the Yuga Avatar, which also coincided with his own internal desires to understand the sweetness and glory of Srimad Radharani's love, which Krishna wanted to experience for himself. Being the object of that love, he could not understand the abode of that love. He wanted to taste that sweetness. But he did not want to keep it to himself. He wanted to share it with the world. And in so doing, he gave testimony to the actual potential of extremely sweet, loving relationships, which we find in devotees in proportion to their purity and freedom from the egotistic desires to place oneself in the center. Or, you can see it all in terms of selfishness. The more selfless our relationships, the more sweetness will be contained. Or, look at it in terms of Mahaprabhu's own eight main instructions for this world, beginning with Shekhadatta and Vajrayana, giving the effects of the chanting of the holy name, how it cleanses the mirror of the mind, and destroys sins, and karma, and all that. And culminating in let Krishna trample me, or embrace me, or devastate me, or whatever he wants to me, because he is my Lord, I am his servant, I'm conditioned. What Mahaprabhu is leading to in the progression of his prayers in glorification of the Holy Name is the most selfless love of Srimati Radharani. So when Lord Krishna came to experience that sweetness of selfless love for himself and share the experience with whoever in the world would participate in the process that he deemed worthy of experiencing and sharing that love, which is the very essence of all sacrifice, the essence of all worship, the essence of bhakti, the essence of everything, the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. He and his devotees emanated such an attraction of loving relationships that wherever Mahaprabhu went, for miles, people would come, and even demons, malechas, Muslims, would offer their prostrate obeisances and leave everything to follow him. They just felt their hearts running after him and irresistibly attracted to the love that he conveyed in his very being. And they forgot all their sorrows and their sufferings and their homes and their families and their domestic duties and everything. But there was no negligence on anybody's part. It's not that by renouncing anything to serve Krishna, that anyone will be bereft. Krishna himself makes sure that there will not be any guilt of not performing one's lesser duties when the higher, ultimate duty is fulfilled. So, when Mahaprabhu was on pretext of going to Vrindavan, but he ended up in Ramakili. Ramakili is the capital city of the then Nawabu Sheng Shah, the fully independent sovereign of practically all of Eastern India, and who was a very infamous, ferocious tyrant who had a reputation of continuously attacking Orissa, destroying millions of temples with their millions of presiding deities. He hated Vaishnavas with a vengeance. He was Jagatsandha for Shamila. Just as the Shankazi of Navadvipa, the governor of Nanaka, was constant. His father-in-law, Jayasandha, returned also in Bengal as the Nawabu Sheng Shah. So on his sankirtan to Vrindavan, dancing all the way, Mahaprabhu, as if unaware of his location, he didn't even seem to know if he was on the land or in the water or in the sky or who he was or where he was or when it was or anything. Just fearlessly, he was chanting the holy names. Now just consider the Nawabu Sheng Shah, who the most infamous tyrant, ferocious terrorist this world has ever known, just dedicated all his spare time to seeking out and destroying temples and deities and persecuting and torturing good people who are inclined to dedicate their lives to the service of the Lord. So Mahaprabhu, who was supposed to be on his way to Vrindavan and was attracting masses of all kinds of people to join in his kirtan, stopped and had continuous kirtan day and night, right practically at the palace gates of the Nawabu Sheng Shah. Now, if you were to try to contemplate any fearful situation in the creation, this would have to be the epitome. To have sankirtan right at the palace gates of the worst demon in the world who hated sankirtan, who had a vow of vengeance and hatred towards all God-fearing souls. So what does Mahaprabhu do? He takes the masses and lead them to big Harinam Sankirtan right at his palace gates. And one of the Nawab's constables came to the Nawabu Sheng Shah and informed him that there's a kirtan going up there. I guess they're glorifying some kind of ghost. So the constable didn't initially start off with a very favorable report. Said, like some combination of chanting and glorification of some kind of ghost. But the Nawabu Sheng Shah was very curious. Well, who's leading this? Said, this personality has a figure like molten gold, with eyes like elongated, beautiful lotus petals. the rising sun. And his teeth are more beautiful than pearls. And even though he's very powerful, so much so that when he falls down to the ground in ecstasy, he pulverizes the stones on the ground. His body is so soft, like melted butter. This is a very unusual personality. I think he must be a great king of some foreign land, and he has achieved a very exalted stage of self-realization and taken sannyas and gone out to preach. And the tears that flow from his eyes when he utters the holy name of Krishna are like rivers. You know, as your constable patrolling your kingdom, I have met many yogis and philosophers and sannyasis, but I've never seen such a wonder as I have seen today in him. And I think that his arrival in your kingdom makes the land glorious and fortunate. And hearing these words, that most extremely wicked, envious, ferocious tyrant felt his heart begin to melt. And then his words expressed great wonder. He said, he is Allah, who the Vaishnavas call Krishna. He has come to my kingdom. And then, for a second opinion, the Nawab Hashim Shah asked one of his Hindu ministers, Keshava Khan, what is your opinion? And Keshava Khan, he was fearful to confirm the Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Person of the Godhead Krishna, knowing the envious, wicked intent of Nawab Hashim Shah. So he tried to minimize the Lord, in fear that the Nawab Hashim Shah would retaliate. The Sankirtan going on in his palace gates. So Keshava Khan said, no, that was just a major exaggeration. He's just some beggar. He just, you know, lives under a different tree every night. You know, a few people come and follow him. Not very many. Nothing very significant. I wouldn't even consider the matter. Just forget it. He's even here. He's just a beggar. And then the Nawab Hashim Shah became furious. Not the way he usually did. But he chastised Keshava. Don't you ever call him a beggar again. He is Allah, who the Vaishnavas call Krishna. He's come to my land to bless my kingdom. How do I know? Because in my kingdom, everyone obeys my command. But in every kingdom, everyone takes his every order, every whim upon their heads. And they worship it with their bodies and minds and hearts and soul and words and thoughts and everything. And in my kingdom, I have so many enemies that despise me. And in my kingdom, everybody gets a salary. If for 6 months I did not pay my subjects, they would not continue to serve me. But at this Mahaprabhu, I notice everyone surrenders to him with such a loving heart. They don't know how they're going to eat. They don't know where they're going to sleep. They don't care. They just come and surrender everything. And they're ecstatic in his presence. He must be the Supreme Person of God. So I give my declaration that wherever he goes, he can do whatever he likes. He can preach whatever he wants. He can do kirtan wherever he is. He can do whatever is in his heart. this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, from fulfilling his every desire, I will personally take away the life of that offender. So then he concluded his talks with Keshava Kanda, every talk with that again, that is Aparad. This is the same Malabhu Shinsha who was so infamous for destroying deities and temples throughout the land of Orissa. He concluded it by divine arrangement. He's come, but the devotees are thinking that by divine arrangement, Malabhu Shinsha is being very favorable today. But if someone gives him any bad advice, his mind can shift in an instant. This is back to the demoniac nature. Demons may speak with great wisdom. They may act very nicely, like Kamsa, such a gentleman driving his sister's chariot on the occasion of her marriage. The one omen from the sky, revealing that her eighth child will kill him, he grabbed her by the hair and was ready to behead her right in the middle of her marriage procession. So when they have understanding of the eternal nature of the soul as distinct from material nature, but if one does not have faith in love of Krishna, there is no substance to his moral principles. No substance to good behavior. And it can change to something horrible in any instant. So, Keshava Khan and others were thinking they should get some message to Mahaprabhu that maybe this is not the best place in the world to have continuous Harinam Sankirtan. So, one of the ministers tried to deliver a message to Mahaprabhu. But how do you get a message to him? He's just singing and dancing day and night, and day and night, and day after night. And the amazing thing is, in that kirtan, no one was the least bit fearful. But gradually, one slight worry began to enter their hearts. That, yeah, this is the palace gates of the worst demon in the world. And why do we have to keep our Sankirtan party going on here? So then, understanding that his servants were experiencing some slight worry, and that Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose remembrance breaks the bonds of conditioned life and overcomes all obstacles and destroys all fears, began to proclaim his own message. I have come to deliver the world with the nectar of Krishna consciousness, the nectar of pure devotional service. And as Vrindavan Das Thakur says, death, time, fear, they're all the servants. And the servants of the servants. So what is the nature of work? And then Mahaprabhu said, I have come to this world to meet the living entities on their own terms and to beg from them that they take the devotional service. So you're afraid that this emperor will approach you in some vicious way? What power does he have to do so? In the creation, there are many Vajarshis and Devarshis and Siddhas, and the Puranas and the Mahabharatas are always trying to approach him, but they can't do it. They search for him, but cannot approach him. But in this incarnation, I did not discriminate between good and bad. God and demoniac, I have come to bestow devotional service upon all. And what kind of devotion ensues? The most pure, selfless devotion of the Vrijavasis that have come to distribute in this world of death. That kind, that most pure essence of bhakti for which the great sages and demigods yearn, that cannot achieve, I have come to offer and bestow upon all. It is only those who are intoxicated with their wealth and aristocracy and learning and austerities. They cannot approach me. And then Mahaprabhu gave his prediction, as he did so many times. Prativity asya nagaradhyam sadhavrsa sarahadivanam. In each, in as many thousand villages that are on the surface of this earth, and the holy names shall be sung. So, the holy name has given Vajrayana Mahaprabhu. That is our sacrifice. That is our worship. That is our meditation. That is our process. That is the means and our goal and everything beyond which there is nothing. We have to learn how to chant the holy name according to the instructions given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. With faith, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performs so many infinite wonderful healers, largely to give us faith in the holy name of Krishna as our ultimate, only shelter. And we must practice avoiding the offenses, which are called aparadha, antagonistic to Radha, whose sweetness and love is the very gift that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to bestow. And that is what makes devotee relationships sweet and holy, but it necessitates to keep Krishna in the center of all our thoughts, all our talks, all our deeds. Not bestowing, not demanding superhuman feats upon conditioned souls, but interacting with others in such a way that our relationships can serve as a living testimony to Krishna's infinite love for the world as revealed in his coming as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to bestow the love of the inhabitants of Vrindavan on anyone and everyone, regardless of qualification or disqualification, not discriminating who's good or bad or high or low or sinful or fallen or anything, just a sign of Christian prayer. But there is a certain responsibility on our part, and that is to avoid the offenses and to protect our faith. The faith implanted by Sri Guru and the Vaishnavas is like a tender seed which develops into a tender sprout and then a little stalk, and it takes time for it to develop into a tree of bhakti and ultimately to develop the fruits and flowers of love and devotion. And we have to be very serious and very careful that in this world there are so many demoniac elements that are focused on attacking our faith. So we have to build a guard, a protective border of good devotee relationships and association to keep out those demoniac influences from weakening and threatening and severing our faith, which is the basis of our relationship with Krishna. That's the negative, to protect that bhakti-lata. And the positive is to always be nourishing in nurturing that tender seed of devotion by the chanting of the holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And serving the devotees with humility and love, because they are the representatives of the holy names in our lives. Thank you very much. If any questions or comments.
Thank you.